Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Welcome back to Viet History Makers. I am back with Kevin, my co-host. I mean, we've been doing a lot of departure from the types of people that we've been bringing up. Today in particular, we are talking about the author Nguyen Du. He wrote the book Trinh Kieu. And I am curious why you picked Nguyen Du to talk about today.
Well, the simple answer is I kind of wanted a break from the 20th century. We've been doing a lot of thinkers and figures from the 20th century. So let's go back in time and let's visit Vietnam's greatest poet, or at least one of Vietnam's greatest poets. I mean, he is such a tremendously important Vietnamese author. And if I could just say, I remember a long time ago when I was a teenager, I was outside with my dad and I asked him, "Dad, who's the greatest Vietnamese author? Or is there an original indigenous Vietnamese text that is like the great Vietnamese text?" And he immediately said, Nguyen Du. And I didn't know who he was then. But of course, ever since then, I've read Trinh Kieu, or The Tale of Kieu. I've read two English translations, and I've actually done an episode on Trinh Kieu with Ian Vu on our podcast, Nam Phong Dialogues. And there we discuss two translations. So the one by Huynh Son Thong and the newer one by Timothy Allen. So if listeners want to check that out, that's episode 5. But today I wanted to discuss Nguyen Du with you. Let me start by saying that it's really hard to overestimate just how significant this epic poem is, The Tale of Kieu, for Vietnamese people. I mean, it's really a national treasure, right, Ken? You've heard of The Tale of Kieu.
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing that you brought up your father, because I asked him the same thing and he responded the same way. And he's like, "That's all we got." My dad was such a hater. You know, I'm trying to scrub this hating mentality from I'm just learning since April 30th that I'm like really doing a lot of reflection about how my father really did not like the Vietnamese culture. And I'm like dealing with it. I'm grappling with that today. But he did say Nguyen Du and Trinh Kieu was the best that we have. And he said it's an epic book. It's no joke. It was a big work. But he's like, he wished there was more of them.
Good. Yeah. I mean, but also, how much did your dad read and engage with Pham Quynh, for example?
Yeah.
Or, you know, Nguyen An Ninh, or many of the other figures?
And you know, that's a good question. That's a really good question, because you grow up and you think your father's reading Victor Hugo, and you think he's reading, Siddhartha, Journey from the East, and Hermann Hesse, and he's like telling you about all these like Western writers, and you're like, oh, so the West has the authors, the West has the thinking. So I grew up with my father kind of pushing that agenda on me, and then now you're asking me how much of Pham Quynh, Nguyen An Ninh, Nguyen Du did your father really get into to really understand how important Vietnamese literature was. So I'm coming in with the bias, and I'm trying now to really undo this bias, that this damage that I think his older brothers did to him, because they'd gone to they went to Quantico, Virginia for CIA training, and they came back, and this young, impressionable 15-year-old boy was coming up, and he was like, oh, the Gone with the Wind, and you know, all of these things that the older brothers were bringing back from the United States had influenced my father at that age.
Yeah. And did your dad read French?
Yes, my dad read French and English and Vietnamese.
Okay. Well, yeah, so I mean, that's one question we're faced with, you know, what great work is out there. And I do think that there's a lot of brainwashing going on in the West where we grew up, and we assume that Europeans did all the thinking and writing. Well, of course, that's not true.
Let me just do our requisite asking for donations on our YouTube channel. That really helps out. You do the work, the heavy lifting of figuring out all these wonderful vid history making figures.
Donations are very much appreciated. I do volunteer this is out of my free time. I'm very busy, but I do want to take time aside and speak to young Vietnamese, especially in the diaspora, especially to Vietnamese Americans. I'm imagining myself when I was 18, Vietnamese American. I don't know anything. And so I wish I had back then a YouTube series, you know, an older person walking me through some of this stuff, so introducing me to some of this stuff. So what I'd like to do in this episode is first discuss Nguyễn Du and the historical context in which he was living and writing. And then I want to turn to the tale of Gieu, quickly summarize it, talk about it a bit. And then I want to turn to what Phạm Quyền said about the tale of Gieu, because he's very famous for praising the tale of Gieu. So today's episode is really going to be not just about Nguyễn Du, but also about the tale of Gieu and why it's so important and meaningful for Vietnamese people. So first off, before I begin, Ken, have you read the tale of Gieu?
You know, when I was a kid, my parents did sit and read it with me. And I have been meaning for years to read it again in Vietnamese. Recently, a good friend of mine, her name is Van Gordon. She went to Vietnam last year, and she actually bought this translated version for me. And it has a side-by-side translated version from Vietnamese to English. So I have not, as an adult, tackled Drink Gieu yet, but I really want to. I promise I really want to, Professor.
Yeah, yeah. Great, great.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
So once you've finished reading, or before you read it, you might want to check out the Nam Phong Dialogues episode that Ian and I did. So we engaged with the Huynh San Thong translation. That's probably the most well-known English translation. However, more recently, a few years ago, a man named Timothy Allen came out with a new translation. And I'll be honest with you, the Timothy Allen one is a lot easier to follow, and therefore a bit nicer to read. However, this is not to say that the Huynh San Thong translation is not good. It's very good as well, but a bit more challenging.
You don't want to put this out there, and I'm going to follow my own advice at some point. But I think what my parents did was we went through line by line, and the difficult part is that this is not normal Vietnamese. Right. This is it considered Han Viet, or I'm not sure at what period. This is probably not Han Viet, but this is probably language that we don't speak colloquially at home. This is not like language you speak inside your house. Very difficult words. And if you can kind of get through a few pages, not even a few pages, a few pages a week with somebody who can tutor you from Vietnam, you know, it'll open up your eyes to what the language is, because they're building blocks of our modern language.
Yeah.
That's what my parents did for me. They just sat with me.
That's really cool. Yeah. Wow. And I don't think you're special or unique in that. I think a lot of Vietnamese people have a similar experience.
Yeah.
We'll talk more about this. Good. So Nguyễn Du, he was born in 1766. Sometimes I see 1765 or 66 or 65. And he died in 1820. So he was born into a pretty wealthy family. His father was a government official. And so he was part of this northern scholar class of people. Now, what's important for us here is that at the time, Vietnam was officially ruled by the Lê dynasty. Now, they were the rulers in name over all of Vietnam, but real power was held by essentially two big families, one in the north, one in the south. The family in the north were the Trinh lords, and in the south were the Nguyễn lords. So it's kind of a civil war. I mean, there's conflict, competing powers, the Trinh in the north and Nguyễn in the south. At this time, because of these wars and these conflicts, there's also a lot of corruption going on. The leaders, the Trinh and the Nguyễn, are increasing taxes among the people. And the people don't like that. There's also corruption. People are angry. And so what happens is there's a revolt among, well, it's coming from three brothers in Daesun village. And so this is what's called the Daesun Rebellion. And so, oh my gosh, what years was this? I should know this. What year was the Daesun Rebellion?
I don't know. That's a great question.
Sorry, this is awful. I should have prepared this. But this is important. So let's get the year down. Do you have it?
No, I can look it up right now.
Okay. So the Daesun Rebellion was 1771 to 1802. I knew that. So there's a revolt coming from this village. And so these three brothers, they're from the Nguyễn clan. They lead an army to defeat the Nguyễn lords. So it's coming from their own people. And this is one of the first revolts against high taxes and corruption. Now, while this revolt is happening, the Trinh lords up north are watching it and they're saying, oh, this is good, right? We'll let them destroy our Nguyễn rivals. Well, what happens is that the Daesun brothers, once they defeat the Nguyễn in the south, they move up north and they fight and they defeat the Trinh rulers. Now, in the process, the Daesun army, it's grown into a big army now. I mean, we've been talking about revolution in this sub-series. They're gathering angry people. They're it looks like a revolution, and it is destroying the Lê dynasty. The Lê dynasty, again, is the ruler in name over all of Vietnam at this time. And they've been ruling for about 350 years, since 1428. Now, by 1776, which, by the way, is the birth of the United States.
I was just going to say.
Yeah, the Lê dynasty falls because of this Daesun uprising. This revolution just destroys everything. Now, what's really important is to say that Nguyễn Du was not a supporter of the Daesun rebellion or the revolution. He was loyal to the Lê dynasty. And he was hoping for the return of the Lê emperor. So he was not supporting this rebellion. Now, once the Daesun army defeats the Nguyễn and the Trinh, the Chinese send an army to restore the Lê dynasty. And this is because the Lê dynasty was collaborating with the Chinese. Mm-hmm. The Chinese had this relationship with the Lê dynasty, like the Lê dynasty was a vassal state. So the Vietnamese would pay tribute to the Chinese here, you know, and so kind of acknowledging that the Chinese are kind of still in charge. And this is kind of surprising to me when I think about it, because we always learn that we thought that the Vietnamese got their independence from China a long time ago, like earlier than that. But no, at this point, the leaders, the Lei dynasty, are still paying tribute to the Chinese.
You know, Kevin, I need to stop you. When I'm thinking about these Chinese to Vietnamese, Vietnamese to Chinese, these fighting back the Chinese, I'm starting to get a sense, or I don't know, I'm hearing from different people that depending on the different time periods, there's no labels. There's no such thing as the label of that they're Chinese and we're Vietnamese. It's just warring factions that, you know, share a lot of attributes like language and food and customs and wedding and funeral traditions. And it's just people fighting against people, not really laid out in national terms yet.
That's 100% correct. I mean, it's false to say something like China colonized Vietnam, because there was no China. There was no Vietnam. What we really mean by that is to say one of 12 Chinese kingdoms was dominating over the people in what we today call the north of Vietnam, you know?
Yeah.
So you're right about that. So anyway, the Chinese rulers, they're getting tribute from Lei dynasty rulers. So one of the Taishan brothers, he defeats this Chinese army, and then he ends up ruling Vietnam. So Vietnam wasn't called Vietnam, it was called Dai Viet back then, until he dies in 1792. Meanwhile, there's a man named Nguyen Phuc An, and he is from the Nguyen family. And what he does is after the Taishan brother dies, then the Taishan revolution kind of crumbles. And so one person from the Nguyen family comes back and kind of restores the Nguyen family. He creates alliances with non-Vietnamese people and some Chinese communities. He crushes the Taishan rebellion once and for all, and he unites Vietnam, and he becomes known as Emperor Yalong. You've probably heard of Emperor Yalong.
We need to get into Yalong one day too.
I mean, he finally unifies Vietnam, and this is really the birth of Vietnam. This is the first time we see the name Vietnam, right? This is 1800. And then in 1802, they make their capital at Hue, unifying North and South and all of that. So, and this is the beginning of what we call the Nguyen dynasty. Okay. Now, the new emperor, Yalong, he summons Nguyen Xu to join this new government. And Nguyen Xu, how do you think he responds?
I don't know. He's a writer. He's a poet. He's an intellectual. I'm not sure politically where he would be standing at this point, but I'm guessing that he follows the new emperor.
He does, but with reluctance, because remember earlier I said that he was really loyal to the Lei dynasty.
Yeah.
And he's upset about this revolution. So he's going to reluctantly serve the new rulers. So in the last 20 years of his life, remember he dies in 1820, he's going to collaborate with the new rulers of Vietnam, the Nguyen dynasty. And Nguyen Xu is actually rather sad at this point. And we know he's sad because he writes about this 30-year period of war and revolution and suffering, the Taishan revolution. So he writes about how the young are going off to fight and die. But when they do that, they don't have any children to tend to their souls. So I'm going to read a quote from Nguyen Xu, and I think this is an interesting quote. So listen carefully. I'm going to ask you what you think about this quote. So he says, so this is about the Taishan Revolution, looking back. There were proud men who followed glory's path. They warred and hoped to conquer all the world. Why talk about the heyday of their might? Remember their decline, their fall, and grieve. Killed young, they've left no heirs. They drift unmourned as headless ghosts that moan on nights of rain. Defeat or triumph lies in heaven's scheme. Will ever those lost souls escape their fate? What is he saying?
I mean, sounds like war and killing is all in the name of for nothing. It feels like what he's saying to me. Like, this is all in vain.
Yeah.
We shouldn't do it anymore.
Yeah, he almost sounds like a conservative here. I mean, he's like really against revolution, you know, against these kinds of wars for glory. So he's talking about these young people, they war, they hope to conquer the world. Why should we talk about that? You know, we should remember their decline. We should remember their fall. They were killed young. They left no children. They're unmourned. They're like headless ghosts. So it seems like he's someone that he reminds me of this famous philosopher named Edmund Burke, who was kind of the forefather of conservatism.
You've brought Edmund him up, Burke, yeah, before.
Yeah, I have brought him up, but he was really against the French Revolution. He believes in slow, gradual change, and he thinks that people who rush to do revolution to change society so drastically, they're gonna regret it, essentially. So that's my sense of Nguyễn Du here. I could be wrong.
Yeah. How do you feel about revolution? You've studied a lot about revolution. Do you feel revolution should be quick and swift, God, or do you feel like you brought it up?
I think there are good and bad answers here. I mean, I can empathize with revolutionaries, but I do think that, I don't know, maybe it's, I don't know, man. Sometimes I look at some of the disasters that have happened after revolutions and after revolutions. You know, revolutionaries don't have a great track record of having good human rights after their revolution. They tend to reproduce a lot of the bad stuff of the old society. So that's one challenge that every revolutionary has to face. How do you create a new society without recreating the bad parts of the old society? That's my way of escaping your question.
No, but it's a great response, actually. I never thought about that. But yeah, the more you think about it, it's almost like hurt people, right? You hear that term. And it's like, if you're born into a system of the way your parents or your forefathers ruled the country, you almost have no other way to handle the people other than the way you only know how to do it. You have no other new way. And maybe you're trying to do it a new way, but it doesn't work because it doesn't work on this people. You have to do it the old way, which is the violent way, the way that you put boots on necks and you didn't realize that you took over the country and now you have to do the same thing to make the order work.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, this is a tricky question for revolutions around the world. Anyway, I feel tempted to go in to talk more about revolution, but let's go back to Nguyễn Du
and how he felt about this.
Yeah. So the new emperor, Yalong, he promises peace and unification after 300 years of political division. The old Lei dynasty was not really a real ruler, you know? So Yalong is promising to be a good new ruler. So he gets Nguyễn Du to come to Hue in 1806 to serve as a scholar there and to tutor the children of the royal family to be part of this new government. And this is interesting. So in 1813, Nguyễn Du serves as an envoy on a Vietnamese diplomatic trip to China, on a tribute mission. So there are diplomatic missions to China, and on these diplomatic missions, they are trying to get experts on Chinese culture. So they get Nguyễn Du because Nguyễn Du knows a lot about classic Chinese literature. He can represent the Vietnamese very well. And Yalong is really going to turn to Confucianism and Chinese models of government, of statecraft. He thinks that turning to Chinese models of politics and governance is the best way to unite all of Vietnam under his family's rule. So he's going to create new laws, new penal codes based on Chinese models. And he's going to say that, you know, we've got to Confucianize everything. He restores the exam system. Remember the Confucian Mandarin exam system? So that system had fallen away during those years of revolution and war. So he's going to bring them back, and he's going to create new schools and academies for young Vietnamese to learn about Confucian ideas, to train them for government service. Anyway, Nguyễn Du is one of these people that he sends to China. And you know, the goal was also for them to come back to Vietnam with Chinese books and ideas that could be used in Vietnam. And by the way, so Hue, if you've been to Hue, it looks like a Chinese, the one in Beijing, right? So by the way, Beijing, the Tale of Q is set in Beijing. You know, it's not set in Vietnam. Anyway, we'll talk more about that. So more on this because it's important. At this time, the Vietnamese people belonged to this, what you would call East Asian classical world. And this is the world where people are studying the writings, the sayings of Confucius and Mencius. They study the classical Chinese language, even Buddhism, the sutras, the scriptures, they're written in classical Chinese. So Nguyễn Du was an excellent classicist. By the way, the parallel for Europeans at this time is how they admired the Greeks and the Romans. You know, like the Germans, they were like, we are really Greek. You know, everyone had to learn Greek. Like the Europeans were looking for their own identity. And so they, with the Renaissance, they are essentially saying, actually, we are really truly Greek and Roman. That's the heart of Western civilization. That's why you see Greek and Roman architecture when you go around Europe. So it's very similar for the Vietnamese. For the Vietnamese, classical Chinese is kind of like Latin or Greek and Latin for Europeans. So the Tale of Gyu that Nguyễn Du writes, it really, I'm going to quote Huynh Sơn Thông, who says, it's a treasure trove of classical Chinese learning. Now, Nguyễn Du did not invent the story himself. He borrowed it from a Chinese novel that he found, likely while he was traveling in Vietnam during that diplomatic trip in 1813. So he essentially takes from the novel. But he did not just imitate. He really controls what he borrows, and he adds himself. And we're going to say more about that when we get to Pham Quyên and what he says. But here I want to quote a Vietnamese scholar who writes about the Tale of Gyu. And so he says, the Tale of Gyu occupies, and this is Trương Bưu Lâm, he says, the Tale of Gyu occupies a very special place in Vietnamese literature. Virtually all Vietnamese know some parts of its plot or memorize some of its 3,254 verses. I remember when, on the benches of elementary school, we were assigned long passages out of it to learn by heart. I never needed to carry the text with me. I simply needed to hang around some adults in the village. While they busied themselves with menial work, they would recite the assigned passage for me to repeat after them until such time as the passage was registered in my mind.
Wow.
Kind of sounds like you know, the elders reciting the passages.
That is pretty heartwarming, but at the same time, it's packed with the context of what this book meant for people and the story meant for people. But I'm a little bit heartbroken. I think I've known that it was borrowed. But I wonder if there's ever been a side-by-side comparison to the original story versus the new as in Drink You.
I think there are studies that compare the two, for sure. Yeah, I think I've encountered that. But so Huynh Sơn Thông, he says that Nguyễn Du's masterpiece is a celebration of the Vietnamese language in all its diversity, with all its resources of rhythm and tone, of sound and image, of terse and rich expression. So by the way, so it was written in Chữ Nôm, which is Vietnamese with Chinese characters. So it wasn't written in Chinese.
Not Hán, so Vietnamese. Yeah. So this is at the turn of the language. Do you know?
Right. Yeah. So there are about, so this is interesting. In the Tale of Gu, there are about 50 quotations from the Book of Odes, which is a Confucian anthology. There are 50 references to other Confucian classics, some 60 translations of various Chinese poems, some 70 allusions to Chinese works of fiction, and some 20 mentions of Buddhist or Taoist scriptures. So this is all to say that Winzu knows a lot about Chinese classical learning and even Buddhist and Taoist learning. So he's very erudite. And it's written in Luk Bát, which is Chinese Vietnamese for the 6-8, the poetry, you know, the alternating meter. between 6 and 8 syllables. Right. And this makes it, I guess, easier to remember, right?
Yeah. I mean, anytime you have sort of a rhythm, like, mm-hmm. you know, 6 to 8 syllables, it'll go in your brain a little quicker.
Right. So there. Let's turn to the summary, a really brief summary of Drink Gu. But before that, I want to read one more thing that a scholar named Alexander Woodside said about Drink Gu. He says, quote, "It's one of the masterpieces of traditional Asian literature. To the Vietnamese people, the Tale of Gu is much more than just a glorious heirloom from their literary past. It's become a kind of continuing emotional laboratory in which all the great and timeless issues of personal morality and political obligation are tested and resolved or left unresolved for each generation. Western readers who are curious about Vietnam and the Vietnamese may well gain more real wisdom from cultivating a discriminating appreciation of this one poem than they will from reading the entire library of scholarly and journalistic writings upon modern Vietnam, which has accumulated in the West in the past 2 decades.
You know, it makes you wonder why there were not more Trinh Gu's written. Why there were not more big works like this written?
Maybe there were, and we don't know. Who knows? I don't know. So let's turn to the plot. Let's give a really quick summary. I'm not going to do justice to the complexities of it at all. I'm just going to give you a very quick 4-minute run through of the plot. And then let's discuss some of the themes that come out here. Okay, so the main character is a woman named Thuy Gu, and she's born to a low rank Mandarin, and she has a sister named Thuy Vân, and her brother is Vương Quan. So the important thing about Thuy Gu is that she's the perfect ideal woman. I mean, she's very talented. She plays the lute. She plays chess and cards and writes poetry and draws. And apparently these were like the 4 qualities that every woman should have in the 17th century. So she was also obedient and chaste. And anyway, so she's a wonderful, perfect, ideal woman. She meets a man named Kim Chong. And her and Kim Chong, they fall in love. Their love blooms, but then Kim has to go away. He has to go attend to his father who had died, and he has to mourn the father. Anyway, he has to leave Gu. So they promise to get married when he comes back. Now, at this point in the story, her father is caught in a debt scandal, and both he and his son are going to get arrested. But then Gu decides to sell herself to save them both. So she eventually gets sold into prostitution. And so she gets put into a brothel. But from there, she's still quite revered because of her good qualities. And she meets a man named Thuc Sinh, and he's very charming, handsome, smart, and he decides to marry her to save her from her brothel life. And so they live happily until we learn that the man, Thuc Sinh, he's actually married. And his wife finds out about him and Gu, and his wife gets upset. And so he goes back home to calm his wife down, to soothe her jealousy. On his way home, Gil gets captured by his wife's servants. And they bring her back and turn her, Gil, into a servant. So when Tuk-sin arrives home, he sees Gil, who is now transformed into a servant. And then Gil decides to run away to a temple. And there at the temple, she meets a nun who then sends Gil to another woman. But that other woman ends up running a brothel, we find out. So Gil is sold again to another brothel. Anyway, the story is kind of like this. It's like we follow the terrible adventures, really, of Gil and how she just runs into these terrible people, you know, running into all this injustice. Anyway, so she's at the brothel and she encounters a man named Duhai. He's a leader of a revolutionary army. He's kind of a pirate. He's not a bad person, though. And so they live together for some time, but then he gets killed by enemies. Gil is then taken by these enemies. And then on the trip, on their ship, she jumps into the river to try to kill herself. But then she gets saved by the nun that we had encountered earlier. Anyway, remember her first lover, Kim Chong, right? He finally comes back from his trip and he doesn't find Gil. He then finds her family. He learns what happens to her. He also learns that Gil said that he should marry her sister instead, Tuivan. So, you know, as Gil's replacement. And so they do that. He marries the sister, but he's still sad and he still investigates into Gil, and he learns about that pirate guy, Duhai, and he assumes that she's dead, right? But then he finds out that the nun essentially takes him to her. And so they reunite him and Gil. And so Kim wants to finally marry Gil, but she's ashamed, and she finally does marry him, but they don't consummate their marriage. And so Gil actually stays as his friend while her sister bears his children. So that's kind of the plot here. Now, I mean, what are your thoughts at this moment?
You know, it makes me think that a man wrote this, and that the ideal, it just feels like the ideal standards of a woman is not, it's just not fair, because what are we trying to get out of this? In order to be a good woman, you have to like endure all of these in like really bad things, these injustices that's happening. And to be an exemplary woman, you have to overcome all this like real, I mean, it's really bad stuff. And to have this be one of the, it makes you question why this work became such a big piece in our cultural lexicon.
This is fantastic. I mean, this is a great setup for a small discussion about those questions you raise. So one can say that there are a few parallels here between Win Zhu himself and Gil. So this is the common interpretation, which is that, okay, Gil sells herself to settle the debt of her family. Well, what did Win Zhu do? So there was a new government, right? Yalong, the Nguyen dynasty. Like, he reluctantly joins the new government. That's kind of him selling himself in a way. You know, he doesn't want to. His true loyalty was with the Lei dynasty. But he's going to sacrifice himself for the good of the country. Because, you know, that's what matters more to him, Vietnam. Just like for Q, what matters more to her is her family. There's this kind of piety, right? A familial piety. But there's also a parallel with patriotism.
Right, right.
Your sacrifice for your country. So that's one. Also, Gil had to endure a lot of suffering and hardship throughout the whole story. I mean, she's just, again, being treated terribly, falls in with the bad people who take advantage of her, etc. Nguyễn Du, you know, he suffers greatly because of his loyalty to the Lê dynasty. And deep in her heart, Gyu says that she's going to stay faithful to Kim Chung. Nguyễn Du is going to stay loyal to the Lê dynasty in his heart. You know, so, and finally, Gyu is reunited with Kim Chung. Well, Nguyễn Du is going to hope for the return of the king. But anyway, he's going to sacrifice himself for the new government. Anyway, so that's one interpretation. This theme of bad things happening to you, but you care more about your family and your loved ones than you do yourself. And so you put up with it and you sacrifice.
Very Confucian, very old school Asian way of looking at it. We in the West do not see life that way, for better or for worse.
I mean, yeah, for better or for worse, definitely for better or for worse. So there are these famous first few lines that open the poem, and anybody who, this will be familiar to those who know the poem, but we see this conflict. Another theme is a conflict between talent and fate. So what are the talents that were given to you, and what are the bad things that you might be confronted with? So I'm just going to read a few of the lines, and this is by the Hun Samtong translation. 100 years in this lifespan on earth, talent and destiny are apt to feud. You must go through a play of ebb and flow and watch such things as make you sick at heart. Is it so strange that losses balance gains? Do you have a reaction to that? I can read it again too. Ken?
Let's give another read so we can process the question that you ask.
Yeah. Well, the question is simply, what is this saying here? The first few lines, 100 years in this lifespan on earth, talent and destiny are apt to feud. You must go through a play of ebb and flow and watch such things as make you sick at heart. Is it so strange that losses balance gains?
Well, that's like, you can go so many different ways with what it means. You know, it's a lesson to kind of absorb whatever life throws at you, to kind of accept it and make the best of it, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think basically. So Gyu had to endure a lot of suffering. Also, so we learned that she's very beautiful and she's very talented, right? But the theme here, it seems to be saying that the more beautiful and talented you are, we would expect that life would be easy for you. But she is actually confronted with a lot of bad luck. So how do we live in a society full of terrible things, cruel people, unjust people? Even though we might be talented and we might be beautiful, we still might live in a cruel, unjust world. And so we could become a victim, but will we accept our fate, right? No, we should fight against it. We should do what's in our power. So I think that that's kind of the general theme here, that when the world throws injustice and cruelty at you, you have to be virtuous, essentially. Very Confucian.
Yeah, but I don't hear any part of it to suggest that you have to be proactive at fighting back your destiny or your fate. It almost sounds like you should just accept your fate. Mm. Accept the hand that you're dealt with.
Huh. Interesting. I guess here, I mean, there are different interpretations, because I've read some people who say that, well, Gyu is a virtuous figure. Because, I mean, she could just give up. I mean, she did try to kill herself a few times here. Yeah. But I get, yeah.
We're analyzing, and here's something that I want to bring up. We are analyzing text. We're analyzing these situations and scenarios hundreds of years later, 250 years later or whatever, we're trying to figure out what the context and the lessons were of morality that was existing over 200 years ago. What if we can never understand what the building blocks of their morality were back then? It was just simple and so black and white. And I think that the more that we analyze our lives today, there's so much complexity because of the amount of knowledge that we bring to the table.
That's a good point, Ken. But on the other hand, another thing we can do today is to interpret these stories for our own purposes, which may include misinterpreting them or creatively reinterpreting them for our own purposes. What was really interesting for me is as I was reading some oral history narratives of Vietnamese women in the 50s or who decided to join the anti-French colonial resistance in the 50s. And a lot of them would bring up Duyen Kieu, and they would interpret Duyen Kieu as, look at this woman who is not accepting fate at all. She's actively fighting against it in spirit. And that's inspiring to them. You know, so it's about turning to the past and using what's useful for us today. We don't have to get the interpretation right as the author meant it. I mean, the whole tradition of interpretation is always about reinterpretation. It's always a debate. So
it's a great point.
So I now want to turn, so this is a good segue to Femke Gwynn. So we had an episode on Femke Gwynn where we talked about he was a hugely influential intellectual in the 20s and 30s. He's really trying to assert Vietnamese identity, Vietnamese culture, Vietnamese language, because he thinks that the Vietnamese are feeling overwhelmed by Western ideas of science and philosophy. He thinks that the West is dominating. Like all their ideas are making young Vietnamese think that the Vietnamese have nothing great to offer. But Femke Gwynn wants to say, no, the Vietnamese have many great things to offer. And one of them is Nguyễn Du. So in the 20s, Vietnamese who were anti-French and pro-French were using the tale of Kieu to debate whether Vietnamese culture would survive under colonial rule. And Femke Gwynn is one of these figures who, he's very tricky because on the one hand, he was a total collaborator with the French. He really was. I mean, he was always saying nice things about the French and he was working for the French, getting paid by them. But at the same time, I argue that he was doing pretty subversive things in his position as editor of Nam Phong. He's going to really criticize Western ideas and assert Vietnamese identity and culture and so on. Anyway, Femke Gwynn is going to say that Duyen Kieu is the cultural icon of Vietnam. And a lot of people know this quote that I'm now going to say that Femke Gwynn said. He says, Duyen Kieu gone, Dinh Ta gone, Dinh Ta gone, Nuoc Ta gone. So as long as the tale of Kieu remains, our language remains, as long as our language remains, our country remains. So this is a famous essay that he writes in 1924. It's called Kim Van Kieu and the National Language. And he says, among the people of our country, who does not know the tale of Kieu? Who has not memorized the lines from the tale of Kieu? He's going to say, everybody of every class knows this poem. Everybody. He says, Nguyễn Du, bequeathed to this country and language, an incomparable masterpiece. So he says, it shines every day with greater purity and brilliance. It stands now as the most beautiful jewel of our language, a language that some consider poor and imperfect, but that could not have more riches, suppleness, charm, harmony, and subtlety for painting the most delicate feelings of the human soul.
I like it. I like it. Big I like what he's saying. Big words. I mean, yes, I think this is a big work, that the biggest work that came out of Vietnam before, after, since. And I you can't disagree with Femke Gwynn. about this, because what is bigger than that? And I'm so glad that you brought up the quote, because I've heard it my entire life. And, you know, you hear versions of it, you know, Kong Ting Ta Ti Kong Vietnam, right? If the language is still around, we still have the Vietnamese culture. And I think that's very true.
Yeah. And he's also someone who's going to argue that Gil was an active agent. She did not accept her fate. So he's going to say that this is a woman who deliberately chooses the more difficult path. She goes through horrible ordeals, but she conserves, I'm quoting, conserves within that abject state the pure scent of her original nobility. And for him and many others, this is kind of like a metaphor for all Vietnamese people. Mm-hmm. Despite the terrible things that they go through, they maintain their dignity, their original nobility. So Nguyen Xu was loyal to the Lay dynasty, but circumstances nevertheless oblige him to serve new masters, the Nguyen dynasty. This is like the Vietnamese with the French. You know, it's like when your new masters come, what do? Well, you do what you can, but you try to maintain your loyalty to the people who really matter to you.
You know, the more we study these figures, especially as we're moving away from political thought, I realize how difficult and admirable it is to have the sort of the expression to write something like this. And I think that we, growing up in the West, we're not exposed to these Vietnamese writers. We should do more of these. We should definitely be looking at more of the Nguyen Xus of the world, because I think there's probably hundreds of them in different degrees of importance and different degrees of their bodies of work that we probably really do need to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if I just say some more of what Pham Quyên is saying here, he's saying that what Nguyen Xu created was so much better than the Chinese original, and also better than other nations' work. So he says, unlike Chinese texts that can be complicated and overwrought, or Indian texts that very often are only compilations or mosaics, the Tale of Gil was conceived and composed according to a general plan whose every part, down to the smallest detail, accords with the whole. So it's like a unified great work. He says that this poem, the product of an Annamese mind, so a Vietnamese mind, as yet unaffected by any foreign influence other than Chinese, should have so many features in common with the greatest productions of the French spirit, is not the least originally striking thing about it. So he's basically saying that, I mean, Nguyen Xu is creating work that is on par with or better than French, Chinese, Indian. And this is a big thing to say at that time,
yeah,
when the Vietnamese are feeling inferior because they don't think that they have a intellectual heritage given Chinese domination, French colonialism.
A lot to think about. Definitely a lot to think about. I wish that I did read it, you know, and I think it's a hard thing to tackle. This book it's a huge, you know, a huge work by this writer. It's no joke. I mean, I think you can go through this whole thing in a semester or two at the college level.
Yeah. We think of great texts, like in the Western philosophical tradition, it's Plato's Republic. Plato's Republic, by the way, listeners, if you haven't read Plato's Republic and you have any interest in Western philosophy, you must. I mean, the whole thing's brilliant. And there are scholars who say that all philosophy in the West that comes after Plato's Republic is really just a footnote to Plato's Republic.
Wow.
But it's one of these, you know, cultural rocks for sure.
Kevin, thank you so much for today. An hour goes by really quick hanging out with you and talking about these political and these writers and these figures in the Vietnamese history. And these are people that as the years go on, I value so much because, you know, I didn't grow up with this as much as I thought. You know, I thought my dad had exposed me to a lot of these ideas and thoughts from Vietnam, but I'm realizing that there's baggage attached to the way we're all raised, right? Some of us are raised to really love the history that we come from, and some of us are dealing and grappling with how messy and ugly it might have all been.
Yeah. And just to briefly add on to that, I think that a lot of young people, especially Vietnamese in the diaspora, are going to go through a boomerang type thing where they get older and then they realize that they don't know much about Vietnam or Vietnamese history or Vietnamese writers, and they're going to become interested. I think that's with a lot of people, third culture kids in the U.S. I mean, I see that pattern everywhere, including myself.
It's definitely happening. And I'm like now figuring out that, you know, when I think about Vietnamese people all over the world, there's different, and I'm probably going to call it out in a smaller episode, just like, you know, like a monologue. Recognize all the different sides to people, because there are people that are part of the Vietnamese government today that not necessarily agree with everything the government says. And there's people on the South that left the government that don't agree with the South Vietnamese. And there's colors all the way in between with their children too. And we're all trying to grapple and make sense of what the last 100 years of the Vietnamese culture has looked like. And I think that if we can kind of like understand, like, there's all these complexities, and where do we go from here? And I think for me, that's sort of like the beauty of sitting here every time talking to you, is to hear what makes us Vietnamese.
So well said. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Granger understands that you go to great lengths and sometimes heights to ensure the power is always flowing, which is why you can count on Granger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRANGER, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.